Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I like to say sometimes the show's so nice we decided to do it twice. Two whole hours of answering the strongest atheist arguments, refuting the strongest atheist arguments with Dr. Carla Broussard, our staff apologist, as I said at the open, our staff Thomist, probably the best equipped or most enthusiastic for this kind of topic. Of getting to the heart of the really big questions, the really deep questions that require, some philosophical nuance and some mental brain work. That's redundant. So some real mental energy.
Actually, it's not redundant. It's not redundant.
I suppose
because the brain is different than the mind, right?
All right.
The mind is a spiritual principle of us as rational animals. Go! We got some serious lightning going on here.
Oh, man.
Sorry
I'm
if you
jealous.
Heard that.
No, we didn't hear anything. So
anyway, the point is you are spot on, Thomas, with regard to the mental calisthenics and the philosophical thinking of how important it is and sort of the fruits that it bears, right, in the importance of reality about God and who we are. So here's an example, Thomas. Consider the previous caller from the last hour, where he was making an argument that our consent is a necessary condition for God to bring about some effect within our lives, whether that be by way of direct causation or permission. Now, if we take that assumption and that principle and think about it, we have to ask ourselves the question, how would it be the case that my consent would be the necessary condition for God to do something in my life? That would seem to make God, bringing him down to the level of a fellow creature like myself, right? Because think about this, Thomas. If God is God and he is the creator of all things outside of himself, well, then there is nothing that would be a condition for him to be creating things and bringing things about, much less my own consent. So notice how that objection from my previous caller is starting off, getting out of the gate, so to speak, with a false conception of God as creator. Because again, if God does exist and he is the creator, well, then there is nothing that would have to be or be a necessary condition for him to bring about some effect, much less my consent. So you can see how even that objection itself prompts us to begin thinking about the very nature of God and what he would be if he did exist as the infinite reality. And then also, in turn, it prompts us to think about ourselves as creatures, that there is nothing on the creaturely side of the equation that would demand or require something of God and be a necessary condition for God to even bring about some effect. So I just wanted to share that to emphasize and highlight the point that you're making, that these issues are very deep, require some effort, but I think it's fruitful thinking because it does bring about certain truths about God, ourselves, and our relation to God.
Yeah, well, look at Carlo proving me right away that he loves to just jump right into these things and chop it up philosophically for us and serve us a nice steak dinner of truth. I think that metaphor works, I'm pretty sure. Well, if you would like to get in on the conversation here, we are happy to take more calls this hour. The number to call is 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. If you want to get in on the conversation, present what you think is a pretty strong argument for atheism, maybe have a little back and forth dialogue like we had with the previous caller, give us a call at 888-318-7884. Before we do that, I think that this is a worthwhile objection to get into because this is another pretty strong one. It relates to the problem of divine hiddenness. It's not the problem of divine hiddenness itself. That simply states, like, if there is God, why isn't he making his existence more obvious to us? This is a, again, like I said, it's a related question, but basically it says, if God exists, why are there honest atheists? Wouldn't God ensure that everyone at least comes to know that he exists so that they can make a choice to follow him or not?
Yeah, so this is a version of the problem of divine hiddenness. Sort of the version that we might call the problem of the epistemic gap or the knowledge gap, where there's this gap between an atheist mind, the intellect, and the target of the truth. It's a version of the problem of evil because there is a form of defect here where the intellect falls short of coming to know the truth. So there's a defect there. And so the question becomes, is God unloving? Is this falling short in intellectual error evidence against an all good God? Well, a similar line of reasoning that we employed earlier, Thomas, applies here as well. God's permission of intellectual error would count against his goodness if and only if he were bound to prevent us from intellectual error. But I argue he is not bound to prevent us from intellectual error, because by nature, as a finite, rational agent and as a rational animal, I am subject to defect when it comes to knowing truth. I am naturally capable and subject of falling short as when it comes to knowing what is real and what is true. And given that possibility of falling short of truth, the possibility of having intellectual error as a rational animal, it follows from that God is not bound in justice to prevent me from that intellectual error and to prevent me from that defect. Why? Because the way he's relating to me is consistent with my nature as a finite rational agent. So the permission of the intellectual error, him not making his existence known in such a way that there's no possibility whatsoever for me to doubt it, it's not an injustice to me. It's simply God relating to me according to my nature. And added with that, as we mentioned earlier, that there would, given that this is not intrinsically an injustice or an evil to permit me to fall into intellectual error, there is a greater good that he wills to bring about from that permitted intellectual error. Now, what might that greater good be? It might be some specific good that he wills to bring about, but I can think of one here, Thomas, and that is the good of rational inquiry. Like rational inquiry, the angels, they don't have to inquire about things. They just know it. Upon their creation, God infuses the knowledge within their minds, infuses the whatness of things, right? They just know it. They don't have to reason from like A, B to C. That's called rational inquiry. But that belongs to us as human beings. That's natural for us, Thomas. And so insofar as God wills rational inquiry, he wills the possibility of falling short of truth, of intellectual error. Well, rational inquiry is a good in and of itself. So insofar as God wills the good of rational inquiry, it comes with it. It's part and parcel. It's wrapped up within it, at least the possibility of intellectual error. And so we can see that rational inquiry itself is a good that God wills, and that justifies his permission of intellectual error. He is not bound in justice to prevent us human beings from defect, especially in light of the fact that we are defectible creatures when it comes to truth. And so this at least shows that intellectual error, an honest inquirer who's falling short of the truth, cannot in principle count as evidence against an all good God, because God is not bound in justice to us to prevent us, a defectible creature, from defecting, at least when it comes to knowing the truth.
Okay, can I say where, like, the next objection that comes to my mind when I hear that?
Sure.
Is that, yeah, that is very convincing when you to hear you say, like, yeah, God is not bound in justice to make his existence perfectly abundantly clear to everyone, even an honest atheist who's really looking for just the truth wherever it leads him. God is not, you know, restricted in any sense to have to do that, whether restricted by his own nature or by something outside him, but that wouldn't even make sense. Regardless, so that makes sense. God's not bound in justice. But the objection that comes to my mind would be, well, what about just God as being all loving? Wouldn't he want mm-hmm. to go beyond what is required by justice in order to make himself known perfectly to just make himself known with certainty to everyone who looks for him? Wouldn't God want to bridge that gap? What did you call it before? The epistemic gap?
The epistemic
right?
gap or the knowledge gap.
Yeah. Wouldn't God want to do that regardless of any questions of what he owes to us or not?
Well, think about this. If he had and must go beyond what is due in justice or not due in justice, well, then it wouldn't be love because it would be justice. It wouldn't be mercy because it would be justice. And so that would be the first problem with the objection. It's confusing the categories of justice and love. To demand that God do something beyond justice is to demand that God be just. Right. So it is true that love and mercy and the manifestation of love and mercy does indeed go beyond what justice requires. But if you make an argument that God is bound to do that, well, then you're confusing the categories. It would no longer be mercy or pure gratuitous love to go beyond the boundaries of justice. So that's my first thought in response there. I had another thought, but it's slipping my mind currently because I'm a bit distracted by the thunderstorms outside.
Well, you know what? Why don't we go to our first break, and you can take that break to try to remember where you were going with that. Does that sound good?
Yeah, sure. Okay, absolutely.
Yeah, that's a good time for Carlo to finally run out of steam there. We'll take a quick break, and Carlo can gather his thoughts again. Man, I don't envy what's going through his mind right now as he tries to tackle all these objections. It's quite impressive. In the meantime, do you like a bargain? If so, make sure you get on over to shop.catholic.com right now and take advantage of the final day of our Book Lovers $10 book sale. 40 of our very best titles, including some authored by our very own Dr. Carla Broussard. 40 of our very best titles for just $10. Just $10 each. You'll see them on shop.catholic.com when you go and you see the little $10 sign next to a certain listing of a book. That's one that you can get until midnight tonight. Midnight tonight is when this deal ends. That's shop.catholic.com to take advantage of our $10 book sale. Shop.catholic.com. We'll be right back after this.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
There is tremendous power in prayer, because when we acknowledge that we don't have the power, but God does, things then begin to move for our good. Remember Matthew 19:26. But Jesus looked at them and said to them, "With men, this is impossible, but with God, all things are possible." Now that's power.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We are refuting the strongest atheist arguments that we could drum up for this 2 hours of Catholic Answers Live with Dr. Carla Broussard, Catholic Answers apologist, author, speaker. You can catch him at our conference at the end of next month, at the end of September, CatholicAnswersConference.com. And you can ask him in person there. About your atheist argument, about an argument against God's existence that you think is convincing, or you can ask him right here by calling 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884, to jump in the conversation and give us what you think is a strong atheist argument, and let Carlo at it. But before we went to the break, we were in the middle of answering one of our atheist objections, which was basically that if God exists, why doesn't everyone who honestly seeks him out come to believe in him? And we got one answer, which was that God is not bound in justice, is not owe that knowledge to everyone that he creates. But then we started wondering, well, maybe wouldn't God just want to do that out of love? Wouldn't God go beyond what justice demands? And Carlo gave us one answer, but you had another one for us as well, right?
Yeah, well, actually two things. I will say this, that with regard to the knowledge gap problem, God does make himself manifest known throughout creation in a way that's enough or sufficient for somebody to actually come to know that he exists. So it's not like he's entirely hidden. He has revealed himself enough through nature. Now, of course, that doesn't totally address the problem. Well, what if somebody in fact falls short and still is unable to see that evidence? Well, I think here's where we can appeal to that part of the question or the objection that appealed to honest atheists. It's part and parcel of Catholic teaching, and I think it's just rooted in good thinking about God, that if someone falls short intellectually of coming to know that God exists due to no fault of his own, and he's honestly seeking truth in the ways that he knows how, then God's not going to hold that individual accountable. There are all sorts of factors that would come into play for which a person would not be responsible as to why the intellect is not hitting the target of the truth of God's existence. And if there are such factors for which the person is not responsible and his intellect is falling short, God's not going to hold him accountable for that, assuming that within his mind and within his heart, he's honestly pursuing truth and goodness and living in accord with that truth and goodness as he comes to know it. And this, of course, gets to the church's teaching of the possibility of salvation outside the visible boundaries of the Catholic Church. And so we can quell the fear, I think, that is the driving motivation behind this objection, right? We got all these honest inquirers, and they can't come to see the conclusion that God exists. Does that mean they're going to be damned, right? Mm. And I think that's often the fear here. And the church says, no, not necessarily, and provides a rationale as to how that would work out. Now, I do think we can say that at the end of everybody's lives, that epistemic or knowledge gap will indeed be bridged, where everybody will come to know that God exists. But again, for those who come to know that truth and were responsible for their lack of knowledge of that truth prior to it, well, then they're going to be held accountable. But for those people who come to know that truth at death, and they weren't responsible for their lack of knowledge of that truth prior to death, well, then God's not going to hold them accountable. And so in the end, all will come to know that God exists, and God will judge everyone accordingly in accord with justice concerning what they were responsible for, what they weren't responsible for.
That's a great way to put it. I heard Joe Heschmeyer say on this program one time that He said, God judges us based on what we say yes and no to, not on what we didn't know and had no way of knowing.
Right. Right. Yeah. And no way of knowing would fit within that category of a lack of knowledge due to no fault of the person.
Exactly. All right. Well, let's move right along then to our next objection. This is starting to get into the area concerning science, basically. The objections that seem to posit a tension or a conflict between belief in God and trust in science, in the human exploration of the universe based on the scientific method. So this objection says that talk about God is meaningless because such a being is by definition beyond what the methods of modern science could possibly detect. So what do you say to that, Carlo?
Well, there's an embedded assumption there, namely that the methods of modern science are the only tools in the tool shed to tell us things about what's real. You see, so notice the implied assumption. This conceived idea of God, well, even if by definition he's beyond what the methods of modern science can tell us about, so that's meaningless. The assumption being only those things that the methods of modern science can tell us about are worth knowing about and are real. Anything beyond those boundaries is meaningless because it's not going to be real. But of course, this is just the philosophical worldview of scientism. This idea that scientific knowledge is the only real kind of knowledge, or that the methods of modern science are the only ways by which we can come to know what is real. But of course, this philosophical view, this way of thinking about the world, is self-defeating, Thomas, precisely because there is no scientific experiment or mathematical equation, there's no method of modern science that we could employ in order to know the truth of that very claim, namely that scientific knowledge is the only real kind of knowledge, or the claim that the methods of modern science alone tell us about what is real. Those are two claims that cannot be known as the product of the methods of modern science, in which case, Thomas, these two claims that I just articulated are not scientific knowledge. They're not the product of the methods of modern science. Well, if you think about that, if they aren't scientific knowledge, if these knowledge claims aren't the product of the methods of scientific knowledge, and of course scientism says that scientific knowledge is the only real kind of knowledge, well then these two claims wouldn't be real knowledge. Scientism itself would not be real knowledge according to the very principle of scientism, you see? And so it's self-defeating. It's like, you know, the snake eating its own tail. Whenever you apply the principle of scientism to itself, you come to see that scientism is refuted. It ends up not being real knowledge. And if it's not real knowledge and it's not true, well, then we ought not to embrace it. And so this is one of the – this is the major problem of this sort of objection, rejecting religious belief, rejecting talk about God precisely because it's beyond the boundaries of what modern science can tell us. And of course, that's just assuming the truth of scientism, which, as I've articulated here, is false.
I think the other really compelling argument against the scientism worldview is that science really doesn't tell us anything about morality. It can't articulate moral principles for us. It can describe what is the world around us, what we see, what goes on around us, but it can't tell us what ought to be. One tweet I saw one time, because I'm the social media manager, one tweet I saw summed it up really well. He said, "Show me the science experiment that proves murder is wrong."
Right. That would be the claim that murder is wrong cannot be the product of using the methods of modern science, in which case it's not scientific knowledge understood in the modern sense, not the Aristotelian sense. And so according to the principle of scientism, if this is a claim that's not scientific knowledge, well, then it wouldn't be real knowledge. But of course, most people would acknowledge, based upon at least moral intuition, that taking the life of an innocent human being is indeed wrong, and we would claim that's real knowledge. That's accurately describing or mapping on to reality. And so therefore, we would be able to conclude that scientism is indeed false.
Yeah, it's a really strong way to strike a blow against scientism, because like you said, we all have really strong moral intuitions about many basic moral truths. Only a few people would bite the bullet and just go ahead and say that, morality doesn't actually exist, I think.
I am very adamant about pushing folks to really think about justifying those moral intuitions. There are a lot of other philosophers that do that as well. Like, for example, taking the life of an innocent human being, especially within the abortion debates, many people, including most quote-unquote pro-life politicians, deny that claim, because they think in some cases it's okay to take the life of an innocent human being. And so there you have a strong moral intuition that's waning. And so it's necessary and imperative for us to provide a robust philosophical justification of the intuition, which I did. I wrote a piece for Catholic Answers magazine online. I think it's entitled, "What If It's Okay to Kill Innocent People?" or something like that, where I try to use St. Thomas Aquinas as my guide and to pull from certain principles that he articulates to provide a robust justification as to why it is always immoral, intrinsically evil, to take the life of an innocent human being. And of course, that's important because, again, as I mentioned, those moral intuitions can wane. And that's important for our purposes here, whenever we're appealing to these real objective moral truths or truths about human behavior, that can be part of the evidence for us to argue for God's existence and, of course, refute certain atheistic objections. So not only moral intuitions can be brought in for evidence, but in case you have some who are going to push back on those intuitions, we need to have some good philosophical foundations for those intuitions.
And isn't that interesting how a debate that seems to be as abstract and detached as arguing for God's existence can actually get down to brass tacks really, really quickly once you realize the consequences of maybe denying this or that truth like a really strong moral truth.
Yeah. For example, the moral argument, or at least I would say a particular version of the moral argument, like we recognize we have intuitively this obligation to do right and avoid evil. So notice, we're talking about what's at the heart of human existence and behavior, the obligation to do good. And of course, that comes into play with arguments for God's existence.
Well, that brings us to our middle break of this hour. And as if you haven't been able to tell already, it's refuting the strongest arguments against God, the strongest atheist arguments. We will be right back to continue that right after this.
What is the Catholic Church? Everyone seems to have an opinion, but the church never quite fits into the boxes people make for it. In The Faith Unboxed, author Andrew Petiprin looks at some of the most common boxes people put the Catholic Church in and explains why they don't fit. In doing so, he brings us closer to what the church really is, the institution founded by Christ. Order The Faith Unboxed today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that, but he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs, but you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
The Stigmata, the appearance of Christ's wounds on ordinary believers. Is it real or fake? What's the evidence? And if real, what could God's reason be for causing this? In God's Wounds, author John Clark offers what may be the most thorough, honest, and faithful reckoning with the stigmata ever written, examining the evidence and making sense of it both medically and spiritually. Order God's Wounds today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We are refuting the strongest atheist arguments here with Dr. Carlo Broussard, apologist, speaker, Catholic Answers, philosophy knower. I think that's a good way to summarize it in a little more digestible way than theologian and philosopher. I think that works for a popular audience, don't you, Carlo?
Well, let's say an inquirer of reality who has come to know at least a few things about reality.
There we go.
And that could apply to the philosopher or the theologian.
There we go. Very, very, very well put, Carlo. My name is Thomas Graff. I'm the social media manager here at Catholic Answers, filling in for Cy Kella today. He will be back with us on Wednesday. Until then, you have me. You have Edgar tomorrow, who will be filling in as well. He's all jazzed up to do that, I know. And we are all jazzed up to keep getting through these objections. And by the way, if you do want to join the conversation, we are happy to have your call. 888-318-7884 is the number to call if you want to get in here with your own atheist argument, your own argument against the existence of God, whether it's one that you personally believe or if you are a believer in God and you've been caught off guard by a tough argument. that we haven't covered here yet, give us a call, 888-318-7884, and we will put you on with Dr. Carla Broussard and let him at it. In the meantime, we're going to get back to these questions that we have already. And so we've explained, or rather, Carla, you've explained the answer to one of the science-based objections we have here. And basically that objection rested on scientism, which is the self-refuting belief that the only legitimate kind of knowledge is that which is achieved through modern scientific methods. Now, there's another science-based objection we have here, and this gets to a slightly different angle. It says, even if God did exist, we don't need him to explain the universe because science can explain the universe just fine without God.
Yeah, it can get the job done. You might identify this as sort of a weak version of scientism, as opposed to the previous objection, which could be labeled a strong version of scientism. This weak version of scientism was actually put forward by the late Stephen Hawking in a 2010 debate that he did with my former boss, whom I used to work with, Father Robert Spitzer at the Majah Center, on the Larry King Live show. And Stephen Hawking actually said, you know, the creator might exist, but we don't need him because science is sufficient to get the job done. Now, in response, we should immediately be suspect of this sort of claim precisely because of the inductive method with which science works. Science, in principle, given its methods, must always be open to discovering new data that could potentially alter its current theories that attempt to explain what it observes, to explain reality. And once you understand that particular method of science and the methods of modern science, you come to see that it's virtually impossible that science could discover every piece of data within the entire physical cosmos that would be necessary and sufficient to explain the physical cosmos. So even just the very method of modern science itself counts against this sort of claim that science could be sufficient to get the job done and explain the universe without the need to appeal to God to account for it. And then now, secondly, I think furthermore, which is sort of a definitive refutation of this claim, is that science presupposes certain features of reality in order for it to even do its work. So for example, science presupposes that physical things actually exist. All right? So if that's the case, well, then science in principle cannot explain why those things exist rather than not exist. So science is limping already in trying to give a sufficient explanation of the physical cosmos. Here's another thing, Thomas, that science presupposes or assumes to be real. In order to engage in scientific experiments, you have to have change. Like if I wanted to measure the temperature, like what degree of heat would be required to melt wax from a solid state into a liquid state? Well, notice in order for me to conduct that experiment, I have to already assume that change is a real feature of reality. That's necessary. Now, if science presupposes change, even for it to do its work, well, then science in principle cannot explain change, nor can it account for why there is change rather than no change, you see? And so if science presupposes a variety of features of the physical cosmos itself, well, then in principle, it follows that it cannot in principle sufficiently explain the universe, much less explain it in such a way that it could negate the need for a creator. And then my final thought is that those very features of reality, of the physical world, that science presupposes in order for it to get off the ground and start doing its work, are the very features that we as theists see and argue as the starting points for reasoning to God's existence. And so change, for example, I just said how science presupposes change, and so in principle cannot account for why there is change rather than no change. So it's already, in principle, insufficient to give a complete explanation of the physical cosmos. But that change itself, so St. Thomas Aquinas argues in his first way in the Summa Theologiae, is the very starting point for reasoning to God's existence. So if science presupposes features of reality that are the starting points for God's existence and evidence for God's existence, then it follows that science in principle cannot negate the need for God, because it's presupposing things that need God. And so hopefully that's clear enough and you can see that. What do you think about that, Thomas?
I think that's fascinating how the same point of departure for both science and God, or the arguments for the existence of God, it kind of goes in both directions there. You see what I mean? Like you can start from the assumption that motion is real and that physical things exist, and you can like reason downward, as it were, to, you know, look at everything we can observe about the universe about this, and then you can also reason upward by taking those principles and saying now this can only be accounted for by an infinite creator, right? It's fascinating how there's that touch point between natural science and then natural theology.
Yeah, and so to state it even perhaps more provocative is that you need God in order to do science. Mm-hmm. Because you need things within the physical world existing, which God accounts for, so we would argue ultimately. And so therefore, you need God in order to, and science presupposes those physical things, and so therefore it follows that you need God in order to do science. Of course, you know, just stating it like that is not going to be received by most, but we can summarize the reality behind it. And so it would require some unpacking, but it is indeed a true statement.
I think you've earned that statement with the depth of explanation that you gave before. I think you're justified in being that bold with a statement
that. Very kind of you, Thomas.
It's my job as a host. I'm supposed to butter you up. Don't read too much into it.
Can science prove that you're kind? I don't think so.
I don't think so. That's
so. Maybe if scientism is true, then that was a meaningless statement by me to say that you were kind.
Good point. Although that is a very high burden of proof as well. One has to dig very, very deep to see if I'm kind at all. That's just part of my abrasive personality. I would blame that on being the social media manager, actually. I think the longer you stare into that abyss, the harder it is to prove that you're kind, scientifically or not. All right, enough about me. I'm only the host. I got to get out of the way. 888-318-7884 is the number to call if you want to get in on this conversation. Not about whether I'm kind. We're leaving that in the back door, in the rearview mirror. But just to get in on the conversation about the strongest atheist arguments, if you want to present your question, your atheist argument to Carlo, call 888-318-7884. Before we do that, before we get into more arguments, we do want to get into our final break. And before we get into our break, I want to remind you that this September 25th to 28th, coming up this month, at the end of the following month, we're going to be gathering here in San Diego with some of the nation's most brilliant, eloquent, and engaging Catholic speakers as they share the good news of Jesus Christ and His Church at our Catholic Answers National Conference. Just probably the most fun 4 days. Probably the most fun 4 days that any of us at Catholic Answers have is when we get to see a whole hundreds of our friends gather at the Hyatt Regency in La Jolla here in San Diego. As Chris Check says, our president Chris Check says, it's the greatest Catholic party on earth. I don't think he's exaggerating there. Important qualifier, on earth, the greatest Catholic party, period, is heaven. But if you want to get close to that, you can come to the Catholic Answers Conference September 25th to 28th here in San Diego. You can see all of our Catholic Answers speakers, all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists like Dr. Carlo Broussard, Trent Horn, Joe Heschmeyer, Jimmy Akin, Tim Staples. You can also see Cy Kellett, and you can see some of our friends such as Chris Stefanik, Dr. David Anders, Dr. Amy Hamilton, Steve Dawson of the St. Paul Street Evangelization Network, who are good friends. And like I said, all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists talking about the theme of going and making disciples, which is what we're all about here at Catholic Answers, like helping you guys to do the work of evangelization that our Lord left to us. You can get $50 off your conference ticket by using the promo code EARLY at CatholicAnswersConference.com. That's the three words, Catholic Answers Conference, altogether, .com. The promo code EARLY, that's how you spell the word, E-A-R-L-Y, saves you $50 off your conference ticket. So book your tickets now. Don't be late. Don't forget, it is at the end of next month, so do it now. Don't wait. We'll be right back to continue refuting the strongest atheist arguments right after this.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
You know, I have never seen women who want to be equal absolutely degrading themselves. And yet the media degrades your nature, your beauty as a woman, your goodness. Let us pray at some point our dear Lord touches their hearts.
For more information on Mother Angelica, visit Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. My name is Thomas Graff. I'm the social media manager here at Catholic Answers most days, but right now I'm filling in for Cy Kellett, who is on vacation back to his hometown of Boston. He will be back with us on Wednesday, but for now, we are refuting the strongest atheist arguments here on Catholic Answers. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 888-318-7884 to contribute maybe your own atheist argument to the show or a follow-up on a previous answer that we gave to another atheist argument. For now, though, we're going to keep rolling right along with our guest, Dr. Carlo Broussard, who has just been killing it so far with these questions. Just really digging deep into the muck and pulling out some great apologetic answers, I think. So, Carlo, how about we continue on with what we have so far?
Let's do it, man.
All right. This, I think, is one of the most emotionally charged arguments, and for that reason, it's in some ways it's actually one of the strongest arguments. If God is loving, why would he send anyone to eternal punishment in hell?
Yeah, well, my first thought is that hell would not be evidence against God and therefore a justification for atheism. Rather, it would simply be, let's suppose that hell is somehow inherently contrary to goodness, that it would simply be evidence against Judeo-Christian revelation. So it wouldn't justify atheism, but you normally hear this sort of objection coming from atheists. And I think what's going on there is they're trying to propose or show an alleged incompatibility between an all-good God and the doctrine of hell. But again, like I said, you could just reject the doctrine of hell, and as because that's something that's supernaturally revealed, and still hold on to the existence of an all good God. But let's go ahead and try and answer the question, because as a Christian, we do affirm the doctrine of hell, and so it is imperative for us to provide an explanation to show the compatibility between the doctrine of hell and the all-good God that we believe in. So this is indeed a challenge that's pressing for us as a Christian. And I think the first thing that comes to mind, Thomas, in response is, remember, what is love? Love is to will the good, right? Now, hell can be consistent with and compatible with an all-good God insofar as God wills the good of justice. And this gets back to this issue of justice. Justice is a manifestation of divine goodness, of divine being. He wills to have an order of providence in which justice is manifest. So how is justice manifest with the doctrine of hell? Well, you have a sin that receives proportionate punishment. a sin that entails the rejection of God that merits or demerits, if you say, a proportionate punishment. And the everlasting nature of hell is due to the fact that this rejection of God is in fact definitive and everlasting. So insofar as the soul is rejecting God, it merits a proportionate punishment to it. So if the rejection is forever, then the proportionate punishment is forever. And we know philosophically that punishment in and of itself is not contrary to love. Nobody in their right mind would say that a father is being unloving when he punishes his child, assuming that there was a proportionate misdeed or a misbehavior or a sin or something. In fact, love, it is loving to punish whenever there is a proportionate crime, precisely because love wills the good. What is the good? It's the manifestation of God's plan for human behavior. When my son does something bad, he's causing disorder. He's bringing disorder into the whole system of things. And that's not good. So when I punish and I impose some sort of suffering or displeasure upon him, what am I doing? I'm making right what was wronged. I'm bringing order to where there was disorder. And guess what, Thomas? My son needs to know the good of that order. He needs to know the divine design of what ought to be, namely displeasure with bad behavior, pleasure with good behavior. And so when I punish as a father, it is a manifestation of my love, namely willing what's good for him. What's good for him is at least to come to know the truth of God's design concerning human beings and our relationships and human behavior. So for the souls in hell, forever they receive a proportionate punishment, and proportionate punishment is a manifestation of justice, and justice is a good, which God wills. And so that's consistent with his all-loving nature. But it's also consistent with his all-loving nature, Thomas, because forever the damned are coming to know, and it is being manifested to them, the truth of God's divine design concerning human behavior. And the displeasure that ought to be associated with bad behavior and the pleasure that ought to be associated with good behavior. So you might say the bottom line is that forever the damned are being dispelled of their illusion that sinful behavior is going to bring them happiness. And that manifestation of truth is a good for the damned. And so insofar as love is willing the good for another, and God is willing that good of the manifestation of truth for the damned, assuming that you have proportionate punishment here, then you can see how hell, this definitive self-exclusion from God, is consistent with and fits within the philosophical framework of God being all-loving. Love and punishment, and in this case, love and eternal punishment or everlasting punishment, is indeed compatible when you properly understand the two.
So I think in my experience, at least seeing this kind of discourse online, the atheist I predict would hone in on that question of proportionality. The follow-up that he would ask would be, how can you say that it is a proportionate punishment? Let's say one act of rejecting God, is that really deserving of an eternity of divine punishment the most unpleasant thing you could possibly experience, right?
Yeah. So two thoughts in response. First of all, the challenge assumes that the duration of the crime should be equal to the duration of the punishment. But that's an assumption we can legitimately challenge. Anybody can challenge that. I mean, if that were the case, well, then we would all be wrong for putting people in prison for life or putting people in prison for a year when it only took 5 minutes to commit the crime. Mm-hmm. So whenever we appeal to those examples, we can see that that implied assumption is false. The duration of the crime does not have to be equal to the duration of the punishment. Mm-hmm. And so similarly, if that's the case, well, then you can't appeal to the duration of a crime being 5 minutes and complain against and everlasting punishment. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, that raises the question, well, what's going to determine the everlasting punishment? Well, one possible answer is that the infinite dignity and majesty of Almighty God, against whom you sin and reject, that in and of itself is meritorious of proportionate everlasting punishment. It's kind of like, listen, if I go and, you know, if I hit somebody in a bar brawl or something, I don't go in bars and fight. This is just an example. But if I were to do that, that would be a big, there would be a big difference from me hitting some guy in a bar brawl than hitting the president of the United States, say, or mm-hmm. the Pope, right? Mm-hmm. The dignity of the person against whom, the dignity of the person whom you offend is going to determine the degree of the punishment. So the higher the dignity of the offense, the higher degree of punishment. Well, there's nobody more dignified and majestic than God Almighty, the Creator. And so to offend him, to reject him, demands the highest degree of punishment possible, namely an everlasting separation from him. Now, the second thing I would say here, Thomas, is that the everlasting nature of the punishment is simply a logical consequence of the definitive nature of the rejection of God that the soul goes into the afterlife with. Now, this assumes a whole lot of philosophy going on here. I've written an article at Catholic Answers Magazine online, Why the Soul Cannot Change Itself After Death, I think is the title of it. Dr. Edward Faser wrote an article, Why God Damns People, where he articulates this philosophical understanding of how whatever choice the soul makes upon death at the separation from the body, that choice is fixed. It's definitive because the condition for changing our choices is being united to the body. So once the body is away, the soul's fixed in its choice. And this is the same line of reasoning that's applied to the angels. When the angels were created, they had to make a choice for or against God, and the choice that they made was definitive and fixed. So if the rejection of God subsequent to death, after death, is fixed, well, then it's everlasting. For the rest of that soul's existence, the soul is rejecting God. And if the rejection of God entails a proportionate punishment, well, then for the rest of that soul's existence of rejecting God, it's going to be punished. What is the primary punishment? The rejected, the not being with God. And then secondarily, the suffering that the soul is going to experience on account of its rejection of God. And so what you have there is an account for why the punishment is everlasting. It's everlasting because the rejection of God is everlasting on account of how spiritual choices work in and when you're separated from the body.
I think also one of the really convincing or most important points that can't get lost in this discussion about hell and the suffering that it incurs, especially the rejection of God, is an exact understanding of what it is you're rejecting. And that's where it's really important to know like what we're talking about when we mean God, and especially when we talk about rejecting yeah. God, because as some of the arguments that we've gone through have shown, you need to understand what God is and what we claim about him, and that is that he is goodness itself, that God is not just the source of all goodness, but the fullness of goodness. Everything that can be good comes from God as its source. So if you reject that, if you reject all goodness, what's left? Only suffering, right? Only torment, only pain. You're separating yourself from the only thing that could possibly release you from that kind of torment.
Yeah, well, there's one goodness that remains for mm-hmm. the damned in hell, and that is, well, actually a few. Number one, their very existence, and as I already articulated, the manifestation of the truth of God's divine, mm-hmm. divine design concerning human behavior, and that's how it can still be consistent with love, God willing some of these goods for the damned. But you are absolutely right, because I think the problem we have with hell on this side of the veil is precisely because we fail to see the evil nature of a definitive rejection of God, of rejecting God as our life's ultimate end or goal. And that's due to the fact that we're on this side of the veil. But on the other side of the veil, the intellect will be keen in its insight as to how majestic and good God is, and consequently, how evil the rejection of God is. And then we will see the justice of everlasting punishment in hell and how that's compatible with an all-good God.
Well, that about does it for this show of Catholic Answers Live. We just did 2 hours of answering some of the strongest atheist arguments that we could come up with. And, Carlo, I think we did a pretty darn good job for what we got through, don't you think?
Well, thank you, Thomas. Yeah, I think we did all right. There's always room for improvement, right? But we did our best.
That's right. Well, we'll see if we can improve tomorrow. Please do join us again. We'll be right back with you, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.